Chapter 5. The Bikini Industrial Complex. Read by Emily. Julie was working hard to manage her stress. She didn't feel great, but she was staying afloat. Until she wasn't. Her stomach had been off for a few days, or maybe weeks. But she didn't see anything wrong when she looked in the mirror, so she didn't think about it. She got away with ignoring it until she woke up in the middle of the night with cramps she couldn't ignore. The family had moved, always an exhausting process, and she spent her first night in the new house, alternately curled up in bed, lying on the bathroom floor, or sitting on the unfamiliar toilet, while nothing happened but cold sweat, shivering, and minor but uncontrollable leakage. When she Googled her symptoms, the internet told Julie to see a doctor immediately. 3 hours later, she was being examined in the ER. They pressed on her belly while spasms and cramps caused more leakage. Julie was too uncomfortable to feel embarrassed, but the word embarrassed started repeating itself in her head while they asked questions about risk factors. Poor diet, sedentary lifestyle, Crohn's disease, recent abdominal surgery, opioid use? No, 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 no. High stress and change of schedule? Julie felt her body contract, her face went hot, and she started to cry. The new job, all the tension with her husband. Doesn't everyone go through these things? Could these ordinary things land her in the emergency room? After an unnerving scan, they had her diagnosis. It included the word impaction. The good news was it was isolated and therefore treatable with a quick, easy procedure that included the word scoop. And her follow-up care included the words bowel retraining. Now she felt embarrassed. Yeah, having a poop-related ER visit doesn't feel super dignified. But it was worse than that. It was as though she had failed, as though her body was substandard because it seemed to have overreacted to the stress of her normal, average life. No, it's not a disproportionate response, Amelia told her over the phone the next day. You may not have been aware of how bad it was, but your body was. Believe it when it tells you things. Julie hedged. My body knows things. It tells me things. Come on. What actually happens? Your body holds on to stress, Amelia explained, unhelpfully. Well, why can't it handle my perfectly normal amount of stress? Perfectly normal? You're changing jobs, moving houses, and maybe getting divorced. That's facing three of the worst stressors known to the industrialized West all at once. What exactly are you expecting from your body? It turned out Julie's expectations for her body and what it was supposed to be were totally wrong. She thought she could measure her wellness by the appearance of her body. Of course she did. That's what we're all taught to do. This chapter is about how Julie got it so wrong and what she had to learn to get it right. On the day a girl is born, she may be lucky enough to have people around her who instantly welcome every roll on her body, every wrinkle on her fingers, every blotch on her skin, and each and every hair, no matter where it is, on her brand new little body. Her little body is full of needs, needs for food, sleep, diaper changes, being held. The adults are there to listen to the distress signals that her body sends out. And when we're lucky, they willingly meet those needs, no matter how sleep-deprived, busy, or desperate they feel. Most of us are met at our birth with an enveloping, protective love that holds and cherishes every inch of our bodies. In that moment, and in that love, we are flawless, beautiful. And then we are infected with human giver syndrome, which pushes girl babies to grow into human givers, pretty, happy, calm, generous, and attentive to the needs of others, while it pushes boy babies to be ambitious, competitive, strong, and infallible. Picture that girl on the day of her birth, perfect and helpless and full of life, maybe held against the skin of a loving parent. She's beautiful, right? She's perfect. And she's you. Here is the secret human giver syndrome doesn't want you to know. Nothing has changed. No matter what has happened to that body of yours, between the day you were born, beautiful and perfect, and the day you hear this, your body is still beautiful and perfect. And it is still full of needs. And yet, by the age of 6, about half of girls are worried about being too fat. By age 11, it's up to 2/3. And by full adolescence, almost all girls will have engaged in some kind of weight control behavior. One recent study of more than 4,500 adolescents found that nearly all of them, 92%, engaged in some kind of weight control behavior, and almost half, 44% of girls, engaged in unhealthy weight control behaviors. It hasn't always been like this, and it isn't like this everywhere. It happens because our culture makes it happen. In 1994, there was no television on the island of Fiji. There were also no eating disorders. British and American television were brought to the island in 1995. By 1998, 29% of the girls had developed severe eating disorder symptoms. 13% developed these symptoms within 1 month of the introduction of television. But in a sense, it has always been like this. And it is like this everywhere. Every culture has an aspirational beauty ideal that women are encouraged to strive for. Our own grandmother told us stories from the 1930s when her family was so poor they lived in a house their father had built from scraps. They were lucky to have a toilet, but it was plumbed into the middle of the house with no privacy. She and her sisters were thin. In fact, they had grown up on the edge of starvation. Still, in high school, the three girls had scraped together money to buy diet aids, which were supposed to last them a month. The aids turned out to be candy, because sugar was supposed to be an appetite suppressant. And they ate the whole box in one afternoon. And it isn't just white people or Western culture. Taiwanese-American Lin Chen, founder of ThickDumplingSkin.com, describes explicit expectations from her Taiwanese parents to eat large quantities of food but remain skinny, which shaped her problematic relationship with food and her body. And it doesn't have to be thinness. The Jamaican ideal woman has lots of curves, and girls have been known to take chicken pills, medication to fatten poultry, in order to obtain those curves. But the pills contain arsenic. Everywhere there is a beauty ideal, and always there are those willing to risk their health to attain it. Far from hearing the distress signals our body is sending, its desperate cries for food, sleep, being held, and in Julie's case, bowel movements, we relate to our bodies only in terms of its appearance. But imagine what it would be like to live in a culture where that feeling we had on the day we were born stayed the same all through our childhood and into adolescence. A culture that didn't constantly reinforce the idea that a girl's or woman's body is supposed to be one specific shape and size, and if it's not, she must at all costs try to make it that shape and size. What if the shape we grew into was just accepted as the natural shape of our bodies, as lovable each new day as it was on the day we were born? What if the body we aged into, those of us lucky enough to grow old, was as beautiful in our own eyes when we looked in the mirror, as worthy of love and protection, as the body we had on the day we were born? What if the shape of our bodies was peripheral to our relationship with our bodies, and we could pay compassionate attention to our body's needs without assessing whether it deserves food or love? What if? This is the chapter where we teach you how to love your body. The Bikini Industrial Complex. This is our name for the $100 billion cluster of businesses that profit by setting an unachievable, aspirational ideal for us, convincing us that we both can and should, indeed we must, conform with the ideal, and then selling us ineffective but plausible strategies for achieving that ideal. It's like old cat pee in the carpet, powerful and pervasive, and it makes you uncomfortable every day. But it's invisible, and no one can remember a time when it didn't smell. Let's spend a few minutes shining a black light on it so you can know where the smell is coming from. You already know that everything in the media is there to sell you thinness. The shellacked abs in advertisements for exercise equipment, the one weird trick to lose belly fat clickbait when all you wanted was a weather forecast, and princesses played by flawless, thin women on TV. The Bikini Industrial Complex, or BIC, has successfully created a culture of immense pressure to conform to an ideal that is literally unobtainable by almost everyone, and yet is framed not just as the most beautiful, but as the healthiest and most virtuous. But it's not just magazine covers and other fictions that get it wrong. Even your high school health class had it wrong. Your doctor had it wrong because her medical textbooks had it wrong, because the federal government had it wrong. Like Big Oil and Big Tobacco, Big Bikini has lobbied government agencies to make sure their products have the support of Congress. The Body Mass Index BMI chart and its labels, underweight, overweight, obese, etc., were created by a panel of 9 individuals, 7 of whom were employed by weight loss clinics and thus have an economic interest in encouraging use of their facilities. You've been lied to about the relationship between weight and health so that you will perpetually try to change your weight. But listen, it can be healthier to be 70 or more pounds over your medically defined healthy weight than just 5 pounds under it. A 2016 meta-analysis published in The Lancet examined 189 studies encompassing nearly 4 million people who had never smoked and had no diagnosed medical issues. It found that people labeled obese by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, have lower health risk than those the CDC categorized as underweight. The study also found that being overweight, according to the CDC, is lower risk than being at the low end of the healthy range, as defined by the U.S. federal government and the World Health Organization. Another meta-analysis even found that people in the BMI category labeled overweight may live longer than people in any other category, and the highest predictable mortality rate might be among those labeled underweight. What? You ask in disbelief. Exactly, we respond. What? You ask again. I know, we reply. It's bananas. Even research that describes itself as contradicting these meta-analyses and confirming that overweight is bad concedes we do not yet have convincing data from randomized controlled trials in humans that methods used for promoting weight loss among obese persons prolong life. Translation? Even if you lose weight by buying whatever advice they're selling, and there's no scientific reason to believe you will, don't expect to live longer. Taking it even further, the newest research is suggesting doctors warn middle-aged and older patients against losing weight because the increasingly well-established dangers of fluctuations in weight outweigh any risk associated with high but stable weight. And yet, weight stigma is so deeply entrenched that even the researchers who study health and weight are prone to scientific weightism, the empirically unsound assumption that thin is good and fat is bad. It leads physicians and scientists to write sentences like, It is well established that weight loss, by any method, is beneficial for individuals with diabetes. By any method? Tuberculosis? Radiation therapy? Internment camp? Amputation? Come on. Weight and health. Not the same thing. Part of the nonlinear relationship between BMI and health is due to the fact that people vary naturally in their body shape and size. Just look at photographer Howard Schatz's 2002 book, Athlete, illustrating the vast and beautiful range of body shapes and sizes of Olympic athletes. Every one of those people, from the tiniest gymnast to the biggest weightlifter, is at the absolute peak of their sport. Health comes in every shape and size. Some people are healthiest at a lower BMI, and some are healthiest at a higher BMI. But part of this is because the BMI is nonsense as a measure of personal health. It's literally just a ratio of height to weight, which is why a doctor told one of my students, an internationally competitive figure skater, i.e. a professional athlete, that she was overweight. Even though she was so low body fat, she was skipping periods. She had so much muscle and such dense bones that she weighed as much as a man her height. And again, even studies that assume body fat is dangerous agree that BMI misclassifies as healthy half of people who are normal or just overweight, but who are nevertheless at risk for all the health issues associated with obesity. People of any size can be healthy or sick. You can't tell by looking at them. Does the BMI chart mention that this codification of health relies more on bias than on science? Nope. It just labels people as unhealthy, ignores the science, and gives physicians and insurance companies government sanctioning to collect fees for treatment of this disease. And we all believe it, because our culture has primed us to judge fat people as lazy and selfish. But it's even bigger than that. Here's how deep it goes. When Amelia conducted a children's choir, she had to teach her kids to breathe. At 8, 10, even 6 years old, they already believed that bellies are supposed to be flat and hard. So they held their stomachs in. You can't breathe deeply all the way without relaxing your abdomen. And you can't sing if you can't breathe. So Amelia had to teach children to breathe. Amelia's young singers show that the BIC doesn't just teach us to ignore our needs for food and love. It doesn't even want us to breathe. Not all the way. Relax your belly. It's supposed to be round. The bikini industrial complex has been gaslighting you. We're not saying the people or companies that constitute the bikini industrial complex are out to get you. Frankly, we don't think they're smart enough to have created this screwed up system on purpose. But we're far from the first to recognize there's money to be made by establishing and enforcing impossible standards by which we're told to measure ourselves. Stigma is the health hazard. What is the cost of the bikini industrial complex's success? There is, of course, the financial cost. The aforementioned $100 billion global industry thrives on our body dissatisfaction, and the less effective it is at making our bodies fit, the more money it makes as we try product after product, trend after trend. And there is opportunity cost. With the time and money we spend on worrying about the shape of our bodies and attempting to make them fit, what else might we accomplish? Along with that comes self-regulatory fatigue. If you're using up decision-making and attention-focusing cognitive resources on choices about food, clothes, exercise, makeup, body hair, toxins, and fretting about your body's failures, what are you too exhausted to care about that you would otherwise prioritize? There's also the chronic low-level stress, like the rats with tilted cages and flashing lights, of navigating an environment filled with images of the ideal and people who believe in it. Even if you don't buy in, they'll be there to say, How nice for you that you don't care. Or, no, don't give up on yourself. Or, aren't you worried about your health? What about your, my, insurance premiums? What they're really saying is, how dare you? If I have to follow the rules, then so do you. Get back in line. As body activist Jess Baker says, when a fat chick who hasn't done the work, who hasn't tried to fix her body, who doesn't have any interest in the gospel we so zealously believe in, stands up and says, I'm happy, we freak the fuck out because that bitch just broke the rules. She just cut in front of us in line. She just unwittingly ripped us off. And she essentially made our lifetime of work totally meaningless. That freak out leads to another cost, the discrimination. People of size are paid less at work, experience more bullying at school, not just from other kids, but from teachers, and have their symptoms dismissed or ignored by doctors, and thus go longer without appropriate diagnosis and treatment when they have actual medical problems. Then there is the cost in human health and life. Dieting, especially yo-yo dieting, repeatedly gaining and losing weight, ultimately causes changes in brain functioning that increase insulin and leptin resistance, causing weight gain, which leads to dieting, and so on, which leads to actual disease. And eating disorders have the highest mortality of any mental illness, higher even than depression, killing 250,000 people a year. The thin ideal makes us sick, and it kills some of us. And although a rising proportion of men struggle with body dysmorphia and the cultural pressures around men's bodies are intensifying, dad bod notwithstanding, this remains a distinctly gendered issue. It is women's time, money, mental energy, opportunity, health, and lives that are being drained away in the endless pursuit of a better body. And it starts as soon as we gender a child's toys. Very young girls' exposure to dolls with unrealistic body types increases their desire to be thin. This, despite the fact that that Lancet meta-analysis found that the health risk associated with low or high BMI was far greater, quoting the researchers, for men than for women. And yet, who gets more flack from their culture and even, yes, from their doctors about their weight? Women, of course. Twice as much as men. Why? Because we're the human givers. We're the ones with the moral obligation to be pretty. That is, to conform to the aspirational ideal. It gets worse. The body ideal is built into the physical infrastructure of society, from the size and shape of airplane seats to the weight-bearing capacity of medical tables. One friend of ours couldn't get a mammogram because the machine at the doctor's office didn't hold over 250 pounds. Outrageously inexcusable when 5 to 10% of American women over the age of 40 weigh more than 250 pounds. This grotesque discrimination means that it is dangerous to be a fat person in the world, not because of the fat, but because of the daily discrimination, exclusion, and stigmatization. Reasonable people may disagree about the specific relationship between weight and health, but there is no reasonable case to be made, no evidence at all, that stigma is anything but actively harmful. Which is why it would be nice to be thin. Owen Elliott, daughter of Cass Elliott of the band The Mamas and the Papas, has said of her mother, she accepted who she was, a sexy woman who was never short of boyfriends. But I think if she could have been thinner, she would have. I'm overweight right now, and I'm still beautiful, but God, it would be nice to be thin, and I think that's where she was at, too. That fundamental ambivalence between accepting your body and changing your body is both common and rational. Despite the accumulating evidence that people of different shapes and sizes can be healthy, the stigma around body shape pervades every domain of our lives, and the prejudice, bias, false beliefs, and stigma against fat and fat people can literally kill you. And this form of discrimination is not just legal, but normalized, rationalized by the incorrect idea that fat is a disease. So yes, indeed, it would be nice to be thin because it would privilege us with the gift of being treated like actual people, no matter what. Thin privilege is as real as privilege associated with race, gender, and class. Women of color would face less adversity if they were white. Trans folks would face less adversity if they were cisgender. People on the autism spectrum would face less adversity if they were neurotypical. And yes, fat people would face less adversity if they were thin. And none of those folks chose to be who they are. They can only choose to embrace who they are and try to tolerate living in a world that doesn't tolerate them. Living in a body that is outside the norm can be a hassle when you're shopping for clothes, frustrating when you're navigating public transportation, and exhausting when you're just trying to buy groceries without people offering their opinions, silently or otherwise. It is experienced as another chronic stressor, like the rats who come home to find water poured all over their nests. And that stress accumulates. The urge to conform is perfectly rational, and the BIC lies to you, tells you you could conform if you worked harder, had more discipline, on and on, bullshit, bullshit, and the stress works its way from the outside to the inside. Even people who conform more or less to the aspirational ideal experience this stress. When they can't credibly be told they have to be thinner, thin people are told they should sculpt or tone their abs or arms or butt or thighs, and everyone, regardless of size, is supposed to fret over food choices and exercise and clothes that make you look fat in an effort to fit the precisely molded aspirational ideal. We've been taught that our bodies reflect our morality and indeed our very worth as human beings. Fat people are viewed as lazy, gluttonous, greedy, immoral, uncontrolled, stupid, ugly, lacking in willpower, primitive. Thin people, by contrast, are self-controlled and nice and clean, smart. The stakes for conforming feel excruciatingly high. People who tell you they're worried about your fat may say, they may even believe they're worried about your health. But since fat isn't a disease, what they're really worried about is your social life, being accepted by your culture. It would be nice to be thin. Why thinness? As Naomi Wolf puts it, a culture fixated on female thinness is not an obsession about female beauty, but an obsession about female obedience. Thin bodies are the bodies of women who behave themselves. Like so many toxic norms of the 21st century, the thin ideal is a byproduct of the Industrial Revolution. Before that, a softer, rounder, plumper female was the beauty standard because it was only the rich women who could afford the luxurious food and freedom from manual labor that allowed them to accumulate the abundant curves of the women in Rubens' paintings. But in the 19th century, with the rise of the middle class, it became fashionable for a man to be able to afford a wife who was too weak to work. It was a status symbol, an advertisement of wealth for a man to have a wife who not only didn't, but couldn't contribute to the household income. Delicate and fragile became feminine virtues. This is in contradiction of everything evolution would have a woman be: robust, strong, able healthfully to conceive, gestate, birth, breastfeed, and carry multiple offspring. So that, friends, is where the thin ideal originates, in the basic assumption that a woman is a man's property, his status symbol, because patriarchy, ugh. Sophie has two sets of clothes, three if you count the Uhura cosplay. She has a work wardrobe full of the kinds of things people expect a professional to wear, which she considers just as much a costume as the Uhura dress. And she has the leggings and screen-printed t-shirts that say things like, Joss is my master now, and what would Jordy do? So when the academic department for which she was consulting invited her out to dinner at the start of her gig, we went shopping with her. Not many women make it to adulthood with as solid a sense of their own beauty as Sophie. She is a confident, body-positive woman of size. But then she has to go out in the world and try on dresses. This time, she went to a fancy pants department store with valet parking and complimentary glasses of sparkling water. She chose a few things and went to try them on. She showed us a few options, including one truly outstandingly hot one, then went to try on the next dress. Which is when we overheard two other women just outside the dressing room. They were talking in hushed voices, but still plainly audible. The first lady said, "It's like she doesn't even care. I'm sorry, but I get up at 5:30 every morning and sweat my butt off on the treadmill. If she's too lazy or doesn't even respect herself enough to," and at that point, my ears filled with the white noise of rageful blood pounding in my head. Through the roar, I heard the other lady say, "I'm just genuinely worried about her health, you know? Like, she's a walking heart attack. And now our taxes are subsidizing her slow death by Twinkies. Hashtag thanks, Obama." Tittering laughter. We looked at each other. I looked at the door of Sophie's dressing room. Amelia went over to the ladies because she's the one who goes over to people. "We can hear you," she said. They looked at her, uncomprehending. "That's our friend you're talking about," Amelia said, and the penny dropped. They stammered and looked abashed, but also unimpressed. Amelia is herself not thin, which makes her lazy and a walking heart attack too, so why would they care about her opinion? Still, Amelia continued on an angry tirade, explaining health at every size, and that size discrimination is the last haven of sanctioned prejudice, and I just stood there struggling to believe this kind of thing actually happens. As Amelia's voice was starting to get to making a scene volume, Sophie came out of the dressing room wearing her own clothes with the totally hot dress slung over one arm. "Should we leave?" I asked her. "Oh, we're leaving," Sophie said, loud enough for the ladies to hear, then winked at me. "But first I'm buying this hot dress." 3 slow, deep breaths later, Sophie was signing the sales slip with us right behind her and the uncomfortable ladies in a clutch by the dressing room. I said, "This is going to be a really funny story a few months from now." "It's already funny," Sophie said. And she wore that totally hot dress to the dinner where she would meet the love of her life. Your new weight loss goal. "Just give me a number. What should I weigh?" you ask. Wouldn't it be great if it were that simple? On top of all the individual variability we discussed, another major reason why it's not that simple is something called defended weight. Just as some people are night owls and others are larks, and our body rhythms change across our lifespan, so some people are big and others are small, and our bodies change across our lifespan. The basic shape and size of your adult body has what neuroscientist Sandra Amott calls a defended weight that it will protect. Eat a little extra one day, your appetite will be smaller the next day. Starve yourself for 3 months to fit the bridesmaid's dress your best friend got you, then eat like you've been starving for 3 months until your body returns to its defended weight. Defended weight tends to go up as we age and almost never goes down. Only a very small fraction of the population can lose weight and sustain that weight loss through diet and exercise, establishing a new defended weight. How frustrating is this information? Is part of you still certain there's a different weight you ought to be and could be if only you had the discipline? Back in Chapter 2, we talked about when to quit. We suggested you make a grid, short and long-term benefits of keeping this goal, and short and long-term benefits of letting go of this goal. Try that with whatever your current body goal is. Or you can listen to your inner voice, which has probably been begging for mercy for years. You might choose to keep trying to change your body. It's your body and your decision. At least now you can adjust your expectations about just how difficult and long the effort will be. You might choose to let go of trying to conform to the culturally constructed, aspirational beauty ideal. Again, your body, your choice. Then comes the hard part. An hour later, the BIC will be arguing with you, blaming and judging you, pressuring you to get back in line. You're going to have to meet the BIC in daily combat for your individual and our collective well-being. So let's look at four real-life strategies for making it through the fray. Strategy one, mess acceptance. Multiple approaches to combating the BIC have been established over the last few decades, and a strong and growing foundation of research shows they're effective at improving health, preventing eating disorders, and reducing the mood and anxiety problems that accompany body self-criticism. Though the approaches vary, they also have a lot in common. They all encourage you to, one, practice body acceptance, two, embrace body diversity, and three, listen to your body. Those things are good for you. You should definitely try them. But neither of us has ever met any woman whose relationship with her body was not in some way equivocal. And no wonder. It's difficult to maintain body acceptance in the midst of the BIC, where you're surrounded by images of the ideal and by loved ones who say, "But you're going to lose the weight, right?" Ambivalence is normal. So rather than aiming for body acceptance, practice mess acceptance. Turn toward the mess of noisy, contradictory thoughts and feelings with kindness and compassion. You know what's true now. Your body size doesn't dictate your health. The bikini industrial complex doesn't care about your health. It's all just patriarchy and capitalism and stuff. But knowing what's true doesn't magically cure it. Knowledge may be half the battle, but only half. When you engage in physical activity, you know it's good for you because completing the cycle and also doing a thing. You also know that most people probably assume you're trying to lose weight or get in shape, and part of you might still actively want to change the shape of your body. That's all perfectly normal. Move your body anyway, because it really is good for you. And smile benevolently at the mess. Some days, it will be messy as hell. Other days, it will be calm and clear. And every day is just part of the intensely body neurotic world you happen to live in. Strategy two, you are the new hotness. All the evidence-based models also include some redefinition of beauty. When we reconstruct our own standard of beauty with a definition that comes from our own hearts and includes our bodies as they are right now, we can turn toward our bodies with kindness and compassion. Easier said than done. Amelia is vain about pictures of her conducting in which she inevitably has her mouth wide open and her hair is a sweaty wreck. I watch myself on TV and worry that my chin is too pointy because one time, years ago, somebody said it was. Neither of us has ever had the skinny proportions of a model, and we watched our mom, who was model thin before she gestated 2 7-pound babies at the same time, look at her own reflection in dressing room mirrors and cry at what she saw there. What she saw there is very much like what we see in our own reflections now. Which is why we play the new hotness game. A strategy for teaching ourselves to let go of body self-criticism and shift to self-kindness. One day, Amelia was in a dressing room of a very fancy boutique trying on gowns for a performance she had coming up. Attire for women conductors is hard to find. Solid black with long sleeves, formal, professional, yet not frumpy, is an unlikely combination. Finding all this in her size, right at the boundary between straight sizes and plus sizes, is even more difficult. So there she was, at the fancy store, and she tried on a dress that looked so amazingly good that she texted me a dress selfie with a caption paraphrasing Will Smith in Men in Black 2, "I am the new hotness." And now, new hotness is our texting shorthand for looking fabulous without reference to the socially constructed ideal. We recommend it. It's fun. Maybe you don't look like you used to, or like you used to imagine you should, but how you look today is the new hotness. Even better than the old hotness. Wearing your new leggings today? You are the new hotness. Hair longer or shorter? Or a different style or color? New hotness. Saggy belly skin from that baby you birthed? New hotness. Gain 20 pounds while finishing school? New hotness. Skin gets new wrinkles because you lived another year? New hotness. Scar tissue following knee replacement surgery? New hotness. Amputation following combat injury? New hotness. Mastectomy following breast cancer? New hotness. The point is, you define and redefine your body's worth on your own terms. Again and again, you turn toward your body with kindness and compassion. It's not necessary to turn toward your body with love and affection. Love and affection are frosting on the cake of body acceptance. And if they work for you, go for it. All your body requires of you is that you turn toward it with kindness and compassion, with non-judgment, and plain vanilla acceptance of all your contradictory emotions, beliefs, and longings. We're not saying that beautiful is what your body should be. We're saying beautiful is what your body already is. Strategy 3. Everybody is the new hotness. Writer, comedian, and fat positive activist Lindy West discovered her new hotness from exposure to positive images of fat bodies and recommends that other women look at pictures of fat women on the internet until they don't make you uncomfortable anymore. She says Leonard Nimoy's The Full Body Project came to me like a gift. She had never seen fat bodies like hers presented without scorn, honored instead of lampooned, displayed as objects of beauty instead of punchlines. And she asked herself, what if I could just decide I was valuable and it would be true? And she felt it reshaping her brain. She later discovered the research that demonstrates that mere exposure to certain body types makes people prefer those body types. At the end of some of my talks, I lead what I call the beautiful activity. I have a set of 50 PowerPoint slides, each with the image of someone who goes by the pronoun she, along with the words, she is so beautiful. One at a time, going around the room, participants look at the image they're presented with and say out loud, she is so beautiful. Then the next slide comes up and the next person says, she is so beautiful. And the next slide and the next person. There are women of every skin tone and hair texture, women with or without armpit hair, women in wheelchairs or with prosthetic limbs, women with single or double mastectomies, transgender women, androgynous women, women in burkas, women of every size, women of every age from their teens to their 90s. The original idea of the exercise was that everyone in the room would see someone who looks like herself and hear someone declare that person beautiful. But it turned out even more powerful was the feeling of dissonance participants experience seeing a body that they've been taught to perceive with aversion and being challenged to try on the idea that that body is beautiful. I have led this activity with everyone from college students to seasoned therapists to medical providers, and the response is the same. Tears and an astonished awareness of how uncomfortable it is at first to view non-ideal bodies without judgment. And of how quickly it becomes a source of joy. You will finish this chapter and go out into the world and notice the diversity of bodies around you. And you will still have these reflexive, judgmental thoughts about the people who don't conform to the aspirational ideal, or those envious, contemptuous thoughts about the people who do, or the self-critical, scolding thoughts about the ways the world tells you you fall short. It will happen anytime you're out in public, on a train or a bus, standing in line at a checkout counter, at a party, at a work meeting, in a classroom. You'll notice other people's bodies, and you'll have an emotional reaction to them. And then you might even have emotional reactions to your emotional reactions. Darn it, I shouldn't think that. That's all part of the mess. Change happens gradually. Your brain has been soaking in the BIC for decades. And anytime you step outside your door, you're back in it. Anytime you turn on a television, you're back in it. Anytime you put clothes on or take clothes off, you're back in it. Just notice it, as you'd notice a fleck of dust floating through the air. Utterly neutral. No need to do anything about it. Smile kindly at the mess and know what's true. Everyone is the new hotness. You are the new hotness. So is she. So are they. So are we. Strategy 4. Hi, body. What do you need? Finally, turn your attention away from the mirror and other people's bodies and notice what it feels like inside your body. Greet your internal sensations with the same kindness and compassion you practiced when you thought about the shape of your body. When an infant squirms or cries because something about her body feels uncomfortable, the grown-ups have to figure out what the issue is, and we teach the infant what her body sensations mean. We coo, "Hi, honey, what's wrong? What do you need? Are you hungry? Tired? Lonely? Oh, you're hungry, huh?" And the baby learns that that specific uncomfortable sensation means hungry. Another uncomfortable sensation means wet. A different uncomfortable sensation is lonely. But even as she grows more familiar with her body's internal sensations, she absorbs contradictory cultural messages about how she should feel about her body. The adults say things like, "Look at that cute fat belly. I'm gonna zerbert that belly," about her belly. And they also say, "Ugh, look at this fat belly. I'm so gross," about their own belly. Even before she can read or speak, she watches commercials and sees magazine covers at the grocery store. And though she may never talk about it with any of the people in her life, she is absorbing the idea that her body is not already beautiful, and that if she doesn't make it beautiful, she doesn't automatically deserve food or love or rest or health. And as a budding human giver, she learns that her body isn't for her. It's for other people. Other people's pleasure. Other people's desire. Other people's acceptance or rejection. Many of us have grown into world-class ignorers of our own needs, just as we were taught to be. We don't even notice that we're ignoring our needs. Our bodies are sending us all kinds of signals, but we live from the neck up, only attending to the noise in our heads and shutting out the noise coming from the other 95% of our internal experience. Imagine that your body is the body of someone who needs your care, like an infant. It feels weird and wrong to a lot of us at first, but give it a try. Instead of just looking at your body to evaluate her well-being, we know that you can't tell anything about a person's health by the shape or size of their body. Turn to her and ask her how she feels. "What's wrong, honey? Are you hungry? Thirsty? Tired? Lonely?" She can definitely tell you if you listen. You might have to stop what you're doing, take a slow breath, focus on the sensation of your weight on the floor or the chair, and actually ask out loud, "What do you need?" You may receive the answer as an instantaneous knowing, or as a physical sensation you need to interpret, or as words in your mind. But she will give you an answer. Though the details of her needs change as you grow, how much sleep and when, loving attention from whom, what kind of food, the fundamentals do not. Your body needs to breathe and to sleep. She needs food. She needs love. She dies without them. And there is nothing she has to do, no shape or size she has to be, before she deserves food and love and sleep. It's not her fault if she's sick or injured. She's still the astonishing creature she was on the day she was born, a source of joy for those who care about her. She's yours. She's you. Julie had literally never thought about what her body felt like. She paid attention to what it looked like and, like most of us, spent a lot of time and effort making it look thin enough. She followed diets she read about, did workouts suggested by fitness gurus, and avoided clothes with horizontal stripes. But her prescribed bowel retraining forced her to pay attention to how her body felt instead of how it looked. A lot of body positive talk emphasizes loving your body for what it does rather than how it looks, which is great as far as it goes, but it's not so helpful for Julie or anyone living with chronic pain or illness. Even though her body looked a lot like she thought healthy bodies were supposed to look, it had failed pretty catastrophically to do what bodies were supposed to do. So she had to start from scratch, rebuilding her relationship with her body according to rules set by her body. There were guidelines to follow about food, but instead of a list of foods she could and couldn't eat, she was told to pay attention to how various foods felt in her body. It turned out what made her body feel good was radically different from any diet she had followed. There were instructions for way more sleep and exercise than she had ever had before, and how the hell was she going to be good to her body and also live her actual life? She realized this question, this trade-off between her body's needs and her life, was what put her in the hospital in the first place. In order to make this work, she would need help. A lot of help. Bodies are imperfect, and sometimes they let us down. They are susceptible to disease and breakage and entropy. Our bodies can disappoint us, and the world can punish us when our bodies aren't what they should be. So we are not suggesting that you love your body like that's an easy fix. We're suggesting you be patient with your body and with your feelings about your body. Your body is not the enemy. The real enemy is out there, the bikini industrial complex. It is trying sneakily to convince you that you are the problem, that your body is the enemy, that your body is inadequate, which makes you a failure. This stuff is difficult and messy. After you finish this chapter, you are going to have dinner with friends and hear them talking about calories and fat and whether or not they deserve to eat dessert and how nice it must be for you not to care what you eat. You are going to hear family members criticize themselves or others for the way they've let themselves go. You're going to want to explain to them that people don't need to earn the pleasure of delicious food, that deprioritizing conformation with the culturally constructed ideal is not failure, and that fat doesn't mean unhealthy. Sometimes you'll say these things. Sometimes you won't. Sometimes you won't want the argument. Both choices are okay. It's all just part of the mess. We'll conclude this chapter with an example of our own mess. At the same time that I was working on this chapter, I was also, oh God, losing weight in preparation for a large professional event to which I had been invited as a keynote speaker. I know from the research and from experience that I am perceived differently depending on my weight, and I wanted to be perceived in the thin way. So one Friday morning, I spent 3 hours writing about body acceptance, and then I went upstairs, and because it was Friday, I weighed myself. Then I called Amelia and said, "This is so screwed up. On the one hand, I really will be taken more seriously as a professional and an expert if I conform more closely to the aspirational ideal. On the other hand, my efforts to conform to that ideal are in opposition to the very message about which I have been invited to speak as an expert." "Yep, it's a mess," Amelia agreed. "But it's also the new hotness." We started back in part one with the resources we carry with us into this battle, the resources that stop the bleeding. Here in part two, we've described the tricky nature of this enemy who tries to convince us it is our ally, even as it shanks us between our ribs. In part three, we'll describe in concrete, specific detail how to win. We'll describe what that daily battle for just a little more ground, just a little more peace, looks and feels like. And we'll tell you about the personal, practical, and everyday things you can do to grow mighty. TLDR. The Bikini Industrial Complex is a $100 billion industry that tries to convince us that our bodies are the enemy, when in reality, the Bikini Industrial Complex is itself the enemy. Bias against people of size can be more dangerous to our health than the actual size of our bodies, and many of the things we do to try to change our bodies make our health worse. It is normal, nearly universal, to feel ambivalent about your body, wanting to accept and love your body as it is, and at the same time wanting to change it to conform with a culturally constructed aspirational ideal. Solutions? Embrace the mess. See yourself as the new hotness. Practice seeing everyone as the new hotness. And tune in to your body's needs.